You're in a good place now. You are listening to Perspectives with Ashley Burgess.
Welcome back live to Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. Tonight we're talking about things that actually took place in my week. I like to call it the week in review. I rarely do this, and I think that it's time for you to hear my perspective. A time to hear the things that I deal with and to go through my daily life and kind of connect the dots with your daily life. And I think that when we can sit there and communicate to this level, it allows you to understand me better and it allows me to understand my listeners. The last 2 weeks have been a very interesting time. And when I say interesting, I mean that I'm dealing with very different issues and dynamics and wonderful, beautiful things and enlightenment and everything all at one time. And it's been a very amazing, I'd like to call it an amazing download of information recently. And I know for some of you, you agree with me. You know that you've recently learned so much when it comes to certain specific subject matters. Maybe you seem to be more spiritual. Maybe you feel more religious. Maybe you feel more family-oriented. Something about you has maybe had a significant change recently. And I think that's because there's an interesting time going on. But besides that, I really want to talk about the things that have happened to me in the last week and a half, 2 weeks. And I think that it will actually put some, link us together. The first thing I want to talk about is I was able to attend a Harvard Medical School conference. And it was at a very amazing conference. And it was so interesting how all the stars aligned. And I got to see and listen to people that I'd only dreamed about seeing and listening to. I got to attend an event that was very pinnacle for me. And it felt so right and it felt so comfortable. And it made me go back as a child. I remember I went to a presidential classroom. I was one of the kids that was selected to go to presidential classroom. And I was a presidential classroom scholar. And, you know, I was in high school and going to graduate in a year. And it was an amazing week-long event that I attended. And it was so amazing. It was in D.C. And we were at the White House. We were at the Capitol buildings. We were, you know, in the Senate, in the House. We were there for Amtrak hearings. All kinds of hearings were going on. We were right smack in the middle of it. And it felt great. And, you know, I felt really good about things ever since then, obviously. But I hadn't really been to a conference in a while. And I hadn't been to something that really spoke to me at that level in a while. And it connected me back to presidential classroom, to being that child again. And being in the right place at the right time. And how I can explain that is that I was able to meet with professors and doctors and amazing people that I've always wanted to interview on the show. And they're definitely going to come up here soon and be interviewed here in the next few weeks. Next few months will be pretty much glittered with some amazing folks that you're going to get to hear on Perspectives. And it just felt like presidential classroom again. It felt like that, not because of what it was, but there were two little things. So first off, it was a coaching and leadership conference. And presidential classroom is all about leadership. And to me, leadership means love, because when you can lead people and you have real honest leadership, that means that you're being authentic, that you have purpose, that you're on point. And to me, leadership is the crux of what we want to be. We want to be a leader. And we want to lead, and we want to do that in a fashion that we respect ourselves. And in the conference, it felt like presidential classroom again. The first speaker that I got to listen to on the first day of the conference, her name is Amy Cuddy. Amy Cuddy is a PhD, and she talks about presence, about bringing your boldest self to the biggest challenges. And the interesting thing about this is that I think her TED Talk about boldness and the way you hold your body and the way you're open to certain things, I think it got about 35 million hits. And so I got to watch her speak, and her speech was just absolutely amazing because she talked about a thing called power posing. And power posing is just like watching how you're sitting. How are you standing? How are you presenting yourself? And she went on with some scientific, research that she had talked about how when athletes win a race or, win a swim meet or whatever it is, they always put their arms up in the air in like a V shape. And she also went further in the research and showed that competitors who were blind, who are blind, who win, do the same thing. And they've never seen it before. It's like we look up to the sky and we put our hands up in the air like a V. And that's like our victory pose. I think it's funny because it makes a V. It's our victory pose. And when was the last time you did a victory pose? Think about it. When was the last time? I mean, a lot of times we sit here at work. We sit where we're at. Kind of got our arms wrapped around us. If it's cold, we got our arms wrapped around. We got our legs wrapped around one another. Around our own legs, not someone else's legs at work, I hope. And, it's like we kind of get kind of small. Our shoulders are rolled in. We're kind of tight. Especially when you're at like a conference room where you're all stuck in there around that table. And you don't want to elbow the person next to you. So you kind of feel like you're in that middle seat on the plane. I've had to sit in the middle seat a lot lately, and you're having to sit in the plane, you're like, oh, and your back is hurting, and you're trying to get, it's like you're trying to put your arms somewhere, and it's like, all you want to do is say to these people, hey guys, I'm the one in the middle seat, okay? You all are using up all every armrest, like, I don't matter here. I wanted to say that so bad the other day, but I ended up making friends with everybody on that flight, so I'm really glad that I didn't do that. However, some people just don't have any compassion. It's like, you hit the aisle, you use the left armrest. And I know that during, people getting their bags in and all that kind of stuff, it's hard to do that because you don't want to get hit in the elbow, all that kind of stuff. And I understand that. In the beginning, we got it. But after the plane takes off, it's time to take that right elbow off the right side, hook up with the left side, and let the middle seat get some room. Same thing for you window people over there. You have the right. You don't have the left and right. And it's like, but the problem is that we are not power posing, right? We're stuck in these situations. We're trying not to elbow somebody. And so now recently I've realized that the more open we are in our posing, the more open we are with ourselves, one, the more bold we are, the more in charge we are, the more at peace we are, the more at rest we are, the better we are to deal with stressors. I look at body language a lot now, and body language tells me a lot. And what I do now in the morning, and you can laugh and I don't care, is that I do victory posing in the morning as I'm getting ready to go out. As I'm getting ready for my day, I do victory posing. And it's very interesting because it affects your levels of your hormones. It affects your stress levels. It gives you self-confidence. And it's interesting how I feel better. I feel good when I put those shoulders back, not rounded, push them back, lower them down. When I can open up my arms and have and be able to use and lengthen my body instead of like cocooning it. And think about it, when people are depressed, they have a tendency of being like wrapped up in a ball. They're holding their arms, they're kind of like hugging their body. They're scared. And the exact opposite is what a victory pose is. And so I got to learn a lot about that. And I thought that was very interesting. And, I understand that some of you might think that's kitschy. And I get it. But I think that it's a simple thing that we can really look at. And she has such eloquence when she's speaking. But it is simple. Some of the most simple things are some of the most amazing things. And so I've actually used that in my day-to-day life. And I think it's very interesting. And throughout this course that I'm going to be talking about, throughout this conference, I had a lot of different things on the mind. And as I go through this, I'm going to go back and forth, okay? Like a good film does. I'm going to go back and forth through some stuff that was going on and how it directly related to the things that I learned. How some of the things that I learned just by being still and allowing things to come into my mind, how I was able to take that intelligence level and bring it back home to some issues that were going on and being able to influence a situation in a positive way. When we return, I'm going to be talking about, dealing with this conference, the inspiration I took from it. Meeting new colleagues. Putting someone into detox. Dealing with clients going into rehab. Having people argue and fight over things that you don't understand why is triggering an argument. Dealing with the passing of a loved one. Dealing with finding your true calling. And better yet, how to find yourself at peace. So stay tuned. When we return, we'll be talking about all that and perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Burgess. We'll be back in. We'll be back this time in Two Shakes.
Turn it up and jump in the deep end on Perspectives. Now, here's Ashley.
Welcome back live to Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. Tonight we're talking about my week in review, okay? We're talking about my week, a couple of weeks actually. I've taken 2 weeks of things that have happened to me. And, you know, I think we need to talk about that because I used to try to keep that out of the show to some degree. But I think that tonight it matters. I think it matters more so because I think we're all going to connect. And I think you're going to be able to connect with some of my stuff that I'm talking about tonight. And when in the last segment, I was talking about how I had recently attended the coaching and leadership conference and healthcare conference up in Boston. It was a Harvard Medical School conference, and I got to hear some amazing people speak. And you know, the second person that I got to hear speak. So we broke up into different groups and we took different tracks. And so I decided right when I signed up for this, 5 months ahead of time, that I was going to take coaching women leaders. Coaching women leaders. And the director of Roar People actually taught this, and her name is Susie Skinner. And Susie's actually going to be here on Perspectives here in the next few weeks after she gets back to her area, after she gets back to Australia, actually. So she had a lot of travel to get to where she was. And it was very interesting because we were talking about women leaders and how to truly value different perspectives. And establishing environments where employees can contribute authentically without leaving parts of themselves at home. And it was very interesting because you're talking about, you know, the difficulty for certain levels of women executives, for women leaders. And I'm not going to sit there and go off on the women versus men thing, but I'm going to talk about the fact that I didn't really think that much about the situation until I sat in on this talk. And what I'm saying is that since I am a woman, I don't think about this kind of stuff. At least I haven't. I've always seen how other people maybe might be treated a different way or what have you, but I never really thought about it. And it wasn't until I really sat back and started listening to the discussion, the thing that I took the most away from it was that a lot of women leaders don't know how to be women leaders. And what I'm meaning is they don't know how to be the leader without being the man. And it made a lot of sense to me. And I know, because I love my family and my mother is the most amazing lady in the world, that she's going to be listening to this. And no, I have not talked to her about this, so I will get texts, but I think it'll be in a good way. Maybe it might be a revelation for her as well. My mother has always been a leader. My mother's always been at the top of her field. And, you know, she's got like amazing, she's got doctorates, she's got all this stuff. And no, I don't have a doctorate. And, you know, I've thought about it, but I don't want to go to school that much more. So anyway, so what I'm saying is that my mom has always been at the top of her, of what she's been doing in her career. And so she's like the top person, really, you know, in that system, in the education system. And my mother always wears suits. She normally always wears pants suits with a shirt and a sport coat. And she always adds a piece of flair. You remember, like, from Fridays, or was it from, is it from Fridays? Is that the restaurant? TGI Fridays? Where they had pieces of flair. My mother always wears pieces of flair, meaning that she always has, like, a cool lapel pin, a girly necklace on, and some earrings. My mom dresses it up a little bit, but you know, when you think about it, my mom's adding the woman back into her attire. And it wasn't until recently that I started wearing these really cool, really long flowing skirts. And they're just so neat because there's different fabrics that make it. And it's just so flowing. It's almost like the Dalai Lama with the flowing robes. I do feel like a lot lighter when I wear certain things that just kind of flow. But I had never done it. And I'm starting to realize that I think a lot of us women out there have never allowed ourselves to be feminine. We've never allowed ourselves to be feminine. We've been so powerful and so bold and so, I gotta be this way if I'm gonna be the leader, that I think that we lose sight of our femininity. And I think that our femininity is what actually allows you to even be a leader. And what I'm saying is that, yeah, you have all these things that make you a leader, but I think that one of the last things that you can embrace, one of the last things that a true leader can embrace, is the ability to lead and still be feminine. The ability to lead and still be feminine. And it took me years to recognize this. And it's not until I recently started buying some of these really long flowing skirts, I realized. And I was like, you know what? I feel good wearing this. I feel more feminine. And I act from a place of even more authenticity, even more from within power. And I learned that just sitting there in this conference. And it wasn't something that was really talked about. But the one thing that Susie really said to me that really connected with all that was the fact that she said that women don't always know how to be themselves as a leader. Like, we don't always know how to be ourselves. Like, we're trying to be this thing that we think we're supposed to be. Like, be like all the men, look like all the men. It's like, think about it. And I realized, wow, I've really done that all my life. I've done that so much that I don't even know that I'm doing it. I couldn't believe it. So that was something that I really took from that. And I think that anybody that's listening right now, I mean, I think a lot of you men out there are like, well, you know what? I have no problem with women in the workplace. I have no problem with women executives. And I never thought that. I never thought that, because I think us women actually have a tendency of us doing it to ourselves because we're raised a certain way, right? I mean, some of us, you might be a little older, were raised in a family where mom maybe didn't work. And maybe mom's position was to stay at home and raise the kids. And so when the daughter was like, you know, I really want to work, mom might be like, you know, hey, if you're really bent and determined on having a job, maybe getting a nice secretarial job might be helpful. And she didn't know any better. So that's the key, is that mom didn't know that what she was doing wasn't right. Mom had no idea. Mom was doing whatever she thought she could, because she knew that there were women that were very powerful that were secretaries that went to work every day, and they wore their outfits and they wore their suits. And she was thinking, that is what I've seen as far as a powerful leadership woman. And I think because of the way we're brought up, I mean, if you're brought up to think that that is the top you can be, then that's the top you can be. And the same thing when I was younger, I go back to my childhood years. And I was a tomboy. And for some of you out there, you might be like, oh my God, I can't believe it. Others of you go, uh-huh, I knew it all the time. Yeah, I was a total tomboy. And I love sports. And I like sports, I think, for several reasons. One reason I really like sports is because my dad wasn't home very often. My dad was out of town a lot. He was a salesman. He worked for Kimberly Clark and Coca-Cola USA, and he was always around all over the United States. And so when he was in town, I knew that the way that I could get my dad's attention was to what? To play sports. I knew if I was like running at a meet or cross country or track, that my dad would make everything he could do to be there for that meet on the weekend. And he usually was. I later on realized that there was a league. There was a city league that we lived in, a little small town. And there was like a multi-city league. It was like all these little mid-cities all put together. And so they had like a call for, for softball players. Female. It was a female softball league. And I knew that this would be something that I could totally do to get my dad's interest. And so I went, my mom took me there, and I registered, and I actually tried out for a team. And I tried out, and I ended up getting on this team, and it was like ABC Wreckers. And I remember we had that uniform. And yes, I got my favorite number 6 uniform. Love it. It was gold. It was a gold, kind of yellow gold uniform. And I remember in the beginning, I was playing outfield. You know, outfield in the beginning, unless you're a really great outfielder, is for the people that stink. Unless you're a really great outfielder, or unless they're like trying to keep you healthy and because you can hit the ball like nobody's business. Otherwise, especially when you're in the little leagues like this, it's because you stink. You're not good. So I was playing left field, then right field, then I got to play center field because the people that were playing left and right field, they might as well have had a chair out there. There wasn't much going on. First off, most people weren't hitting it that far. And second of all, they weren't able to catch it. When we return, we can talk about more of my tomboy years, and what that meant to me, and how that directly relates to leadership with women. And better yet, we're going to be talking more about the other situations that I dealt with throughout the last week and a half. Stay tuned, because my week in review, Perspectives with Ashley Burgess, will be back in. Be back this time in 2 shakes.
This is Jake Busey, and you're listening to Perspectives with Ashley Burgess.
Welcome back live to Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. Tonight we're talking about my week in review, about a couple of weeks, a week and a half and change, and we're talking about my perspective on a lot of things, and better yet, I think you're going to really connect with me tonight's show, and I think it might actually shed some light on some stuff that you might be going through. And right before the break, I was talking about leadership and the female perspective on leadership and how... One of the things that I took from Susie Skinner's conversation when we broke out into our different sections and groups was that she said that the woman leader doesn't necessarily know how to be a woman leader. And I started thinking about that. I realized my mom, for example, my mom is an amazing leader, but she always wore like suits, like a sport coat, a shirt, and slacks. And she would add pieces of flair to that. And while I mean pieces of flair, I'm using that whole TGI Fridays thing, but the pieces of flair. I mean, remember, Office? I can't remember the name of the movie, but it had, like, Jennifer Aniston in it and everything. She had to have her pieces of flair. But anyway, back on topic. My mom would put on, like, she puts on, like, earrings and nice feminine, like, necklace and, like, a little lapel pin on her suit jacket. And I thought about that, and I realized from my own perspective that it was very long time. It's just now recently that I've actually started wearing very flowing skirts. And yes, I've worn like pencil skirts and that kind of sort of thing, but I'm talking about very flowing, very feminine clothing. And it took me just recently to do that, to be a leader, to step into that role and to still feel like a leader with a long skirt on. And it really put in perspective, and that's why we're talking about me being a tomboy, because when I was young, I was a tomboy. And the reason why I was a tomboy is that I like sports. But I knew that my dad really liked sports. And my dad wasn't in town a lot. He traveled all the time. He was in sales. He traveled all over the United States. And so he wasn't really around. But when I did have a meet, and it didn't happen all the time, but he would make it a point. If he could get in town early enough to be at my cross-country meet or my track meet or the basketball game, he would do it. And so eventually when they had an open call for a softball league, and it was like a tri-city area where, you know, everybody like kind of got into these teams. And it was interesting because the team that I wanted to be in, I thought it was odd that they had us try out, but at the time I didn't really know what was going on. I had no idea that there were coaches that were actually betting on Little League softball. Well, it wasn't Little League, it was female softball, later on female fast pitch softball, but We'll leave that alone for right now. And like I was saying, you know, I started out in the outfield. And for any of y'all listening, anytime that you're kind of young in a sport, especially like female softball like that, when you go to the outfield, that means that you stink. You're not very good. Because there's two reasons for that. One is you haven't shown that you can do anything at the baseline. Second thing is that usually in that kind of league format, rarely do hits go out to the outfield. Rarely. And if they do, that means that somebody's clearly a good hitter. So I was on left field, then I went to right field, and then I went to center field because our left and right fielders, which they put in, could not catch the ball. So they just said, Ashley, anything that comes to the outfield, you field it. So that's just exactly what I did. And so the cool thing is that my dad would get really into this, and he really liked the fact that I was playing. And so when he was in town, we would do what? We would play catch. We would get the bat out and, you know, and we would hit the ball. I would feel the ball. We would do that for hours. We'd oil up my glove. I remember the oiling up of the glove, and I remember the color of my glove. I had a black Rawlings glove, and I remember putting the softball in there, and we had oiled it all up. After we oiled it up, and you take the ball and you throw it you throw it in over and over again, and finally you close it up and you put a rubber band around it. And it allows you to really have that spot, that sweet spot, right? And so my dad would be like, "Did you oil your glove today? Got the rubber band on it?" And so every night when we got done, we'd oil up the glove, we'd put it in a certain place, and it became like this ritual. And my dad and I got really connected that way, and it was really cool. And so I continued to play, even though my mother wanted me to play the piano so bad. I love you, Mom, I know. She wanted me to play the piano so bad. And I was really good at the violin before. I had no practice either. I didn't know how I did it, but you know what? I should have practiced. I mean, you know, that's not something to boast and brag about. However, I got into sports just to kind of, you know, get more attention. And so the first year, I remember us winning the whole thing. We won the entire competition. It was like 50-something games, at least. I remember double hitters. I remember getting out there at midnight. I remember my mom just so angry about some of the stuff, but it was funny. But I look back at that, and I realize that to a degree on that tomboy thing, there were certain things that I didn't grow out of. Because I think to a degree, to feel like you were taken serious in this world, I felt like you had to be more like a man. And, you know, I think that's interesting because I feel like to a degree it is. And I think for all you men out there listening going, "Oh, well, this is just BS." I'm not saying that you're putting women down. I'm saying that a lot of women, we come in with this theory. We come in with this projection. And I think that's why there's a lot of women leaders out there that don't know exactly how to lead with their own authentic voice because they just don't know. Because they're like, "I don't want to stand out too much. I want to follow what's worked." But in the same time, once I put that flowing skirt on, I felt so instinctively as a leader, but I felt so powerful within myself, and I felt even more dynamically authentic. I felt even more dynamically authentic. And I just couldn't believe it. I really was absolutely amazed. And so after speaking with Susie, and she's agreeing to come on the show, when she gets back to Australia, she'll be back in Australia in a couple of weeks. And after that, we will definitely interview her from Australia for Perspectives with Ashley Burgess. After that, I actually had some friends that were on that same, we were going through that same track. And I said, "Hey, there's going to be a speaker right after that. It's a guy named Rudolph Tanzi. A lot of people call him Rudy Tanzi, PhD, and he's a director of genetics. Excuse me, my goodness. Ashley, get a word out for love of God. He is the director of genetics and aging research unit at Massachusetts General Hospital. And so this guy's pretty cool. He's actually written two books with Deepak Chopra, amongst all his other studies and books, and very interesting guy. And it's cool because he's a professor of neurology at Harvard University, vice chair of neurology and director of genetics and aging research unit at Mass General. He directs the Alzheimer's Genome Project, and over the past 3 decades, discovered many of the genes responsible for Alzheimer's disease genes and other neurological genes, which is very interesting. So basically, his talk was about what? Alzheimer's. About dementia. And it was very interesting because he put up some various slides, and I'm trying to pull up this slide right now because I want to read this to you because it floored me, and I think that you need to know this as well. And the reason why I'm telling you this is because I think that once we get information, the last thing we want to do is keep it just for ourselves. We want to tell other people. And so he was talking about the impact of Alzheimer's. And I don't know. I know that a lot of people listening tonight to Perspectives has had at least one person diagnosed with Alzheimer's, know somebody that's been family member, a friend, a coworker. Maybe you're the child of a parent that has Alzheimer's or had Alzheimer's or passed away from Alzheimer's. And it was interesting because as I'm listening to the speech, I had been currently dealing with a friend of mine who had finally stepped up to the plate and told people that he was on drugs again. And that he had started taking drugs again, and he had gone through a rehab process for about a year. It didn't work. And he said, "Please don't look down at me, but I just need help." And to me, when somebody says they need help, man, that's just a glorious, glorious day. And so a lot of stuff with him was weighing on me a little bit, not in a bad way, but just on a thoughtful way. And he had gone into detox, and the stuff that he was on was pretty hardcore. He was on heroin, I think snorting heroin and then doing ice. And at the same time, doing a lot of benzos, a lot of Xanax, what have you. And I knew that there was a combination of depression involved here as well. But the first thing is that you have to get off the drugs. And so he went into detox. And at the time that I went to this conference, this all happened last week and this week. At the time that I went up to the conference, he had just gone into detox. And so that was kind of weighing on my mind, too. And one of the things about him is that his maternal mother got dementia, was diagnosed with dementia at a very early age, like in her early 50s. And my friend is in his like mid 40s. And that was a thought that I had. And when we were turning on me talking about what actually came to pass in my own mind, what I learned and the revelation that came about, where all of a sudden we get the whole family together to discuss the situation. Stay tuned when we return to me talking more about these revelations and more about my perspective. Perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Burgess, will be back in. Be back this time in two shakes. You could
be my luck. Get in here. You're listening to Perspectives with Ashley Burgess. We'll be safe and
sound. Welcome back live to Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. If you just now join us, I've been talking about this conference that I went to for healthcare and leadership at Harvard University, and how in this one speech that I went into, it was a conversation on dementia and on Alzheimer's. And Rudy Tanzi, he actually is the director of aging and research at Mass General, as well as he's a professor of neurology at Harvard University. Very interesting guy. He's written a couple books with Deepak Chopra, just to name a few, on the mind and how to be mindful. And he was talking about Alzheimer's, so I want to give you some statistics, the statistics that I was telling you about, of the impact on Alzheimer's, just to put it in perspective of how big a deal this really is. Okay, guys, 5.4 million victims in the United States, 3.5 million deaths from Alzheimer's from 2000 to 2010, 3.5, 13 million family members who are impacted, 15 million unpaid caregivers. It cost the USA $214 billion dollars a year, and approximately 40 million people worldwide have Alzheimer's. They are claiming that in 2040, there will be over 100 million people, 100 million people with Alzheimer's. That's a lot. That is a lot. And so when I'm sitting there listening to Dr. Rudy talk about all this amazing stuff, I was thinking about my friend who had recently gone into detox, and he had been on drugs and alcohol, and he had relapsed off of a rehab, and he needed our help. And I was thinking about him, and I was also realizing that the last time I talked to him, his like spatial thoughts and timing was a little off. And I remember his mother had an early onset of dementia, and I started thinking about that as I'm listening to Dr. Rudy talk. And, you know, really a fast forward, because I'm going to come back and forth. We're going to go up and down and all around. Not this time, baby. I mean, yes, this time, baby. Yeah, we're going to go all around. When I was on my flight heading home, I sat next to an amazing gentleman. He's a speaker who deals with crisis and natural disasters, and he was going into a group to discuss, natural disasters casualties with hurricanes involvement on the coast. We were sitting there talking, and he's also a lawyer. And he said that he loved being a lawyer. He really loved working with clients, and he said one of his last clients that he was really working directly without corporate clients, he said this lady was an amazing, brilliant PhD at Harvard. I can't remember what she taught, but he said she was just a brilliant genius lady. And he goes, and I was basically taking care of, you know, of her estate and all her stuff. And she had a significant other, but they never wanted to get married because they figured out all these tax loopholes and all this stuff. Both of them taught at Harvard. Both of them went there. He said they were very intelligent people. He said, but he ended up getting Alzheimer's dementia, And then she did. And he said that she would start getting very combative with him, very argumentative. And it wasn't, he didn't know that she had dementia. You have to understand. So there she would come into the office getting very argumentative, being very angry, very testy, short fuse. And he was trying to figure out how to manage the situation. He didn't know how to deal with it. So he just said that, I just became very compassionate. And he goes, I realized there had to have been something wrong because she's not a mean person. She was not a argumentative person. He said, so I didn't really know. And he goes, and it wasn't until it got really bad that we realized that she had had dementia this whole time. And he goes, and some of the things that she would say was, I just want my stuff. Is this my stuff? I don't want anybody touching my stuff. I don't want anybody over here. I mean, all kinds of stuff. And he said that toward the end, though, you know, they would be standing in her house and she'd be like, wow, you know, whose is this? And they'd be like, this is your house. Whose are these things? These are all your things. And he said about a year after that, she passed away from dementia, but from Alzheimer's. And as I'm listening to him talk, and I'm thinking about Dr. Rudy's conversation at the conference, and I intermix this in with my friend that's in detox, and with his background and his mom having an early onset of dementia. And so fast forward 2 days later to Monday, where I get a call from one of his relatives saying, please, I would love it if you could come by and talk to him because I think he needs some help in figuring out what to do. And they said, you know, we're putting our hands in the air. We just need him to do what's right and to get sober. And that's what truly matters. So I get to where they were at and he's acting very combative. He's very argumentative. He's very combative. And he's like, you know, these people are lying to me. They're lying to me. They're so full of crap. They're lying to me. I know you're not going to lie to me. You're not going to lie to me, right? You're not going to lie to me. And I was like, no, I'm not going to lie to you. They're not lying to you either. If they were going to lie to you, they would have done it a long time ago. If they were to lie to you, they'd probably just not be around. And so the lady looks at him. Another lady looks at him and goes, you know that you will be, his name is Danny. And they go, Danny, you know that you're going to go in for treatment for a year and a half to a treatment facility. And he goes, yes, I know. And she goes, okay, how long is that? And he's like, that's 2 months. She goes, no. And I could tell that at first she thought he was saying, no, I'm only going in for 2 months. And she said, Danny, no, you're going in for a year and a half, not 2 months. And he goes, oh, yeah, well, okay, 4 months. And she goes, no, not 4 months, a year and a half. And at that time, I could tell that we all kind of looked at each other. And then I started wondering, I'm like, wait a second. Is he actually having a difficult time figuring out how much time and what does time mean? So I asked a few other questions and it became glaringly clear to me that it wasn't that he was reacting and telling us that he was going to do something or another. It was that he actually believed that a year and a half was really 2 months. So, you know, the next thing you know, I said, hey, you know, everybody just wants you to get treatment. Everybody wants you to get it well because you matter and we care. And then the combative and the argumentative thing starts shooting back up again. And he's like, well, I just want to go back to my own house. I just want to go home. I don't know why y'all are doing this to me. I don't know why y'all are being so mean to me. You're being so mean. You're being so mean to me. Why are we being mean? You're being mean to me because I just want to go home and look at my stuff. I just want to go home and see my stuff. I just want to go home and look at my stuff. I just want to lay in my own bed. I want to just sleep in my own bed. I don't know why y'all can't let me sleep in my own bed. I just want to sleep in my own bed. And so he finally looks at all of us and he goes, give me my keys to my house. He goes, I'm leaving. And we're like, you don't have a car. He goes, I don't care. I'm going to walk home. And I knew it was several miles away, but we handed him his keys nonetheless. And he grabbed his bag and he walked out the door. And at that exact moment, I looked at everybody and I said, I have something I want to talk about. I have something that I'd like to bring up to everybody. And I want everybody to think about it and decide if this seems like a legitimate thing. Could this be? Is this a possibility? And so everybody got quiet, looked at me. And I said, you know, I get concerned because, you know, I just got back from this conference and And his talk about wanting to see his things, and his talk about wanting to lay in his own bed, and his talk about how we're very mean to him, and this, and the biggest thing that got me is the 18 months or the year and a half is 2 months. And I said, I don't know about y'all, but he guessed like 3 or 4 times and still didn't get it right. And I said, I have a feeling that there is obviously some mental illness that's involved, some depression and what have you, that actually leads you to wanting to do drugs, to forget your life, to go into a different world, to escape. At the same time, I wonder if we're dealing with somebody with the early onset of dementia. And maybe the drugs, which I'm sure have helped to speed it up, have caused this to happen, coupled with the depression, coupled with coming down, coupled with the detox thing, all that coupled together is causing this, because he's not a reactive person. He's not normally a very angry person. He normally doesn't sit there and fight with people. So everybody looked at me and they went, oh my God, we talked about that yesterday. And as they said that, we all looked at each other, and I looked out the window to see where he was, to see how far he had gone. And next thing you know, the door opens and he walks back in. And he said, y'all are just so mean. Y'all are just so mean. And I said, well, what happened? He goes, what do you mean? I go, well, you're going to leave? He's like, well, leave where? And it all hit everybody at that exact moment that we're dealing with a different type of thing. It wasn't just him being combative. It wasn't just him, and it wasn't just the drugs talking. There's a lot of other things at stake. And it took me to be in an environment, to listen to a situation, to listen to a conference of about people that really knew what they were doing, to couple that up with, you know, listening to Dr. Rudy, then to couple that up with being on a flight with the guy next to me is a lawyer that actually worked with, you know, couples and people that actually had dementia and what happened in those situations. And put together made it so vividly clear what was going on to some degree. And so now at this point, everybody wants to see him get better and everybody wants to see him get well, but we know that there's other things at stake. When we return, we'll be talking more about that. We'll also be talking about some really neat stuff that came up with Jim Carrey, and also talking about dealing with family dynamics and how to not have regrets. Stay tuned, because Perspectives, your host, me, Ashley Burgess, will be back this time in 2 shakes.
You're in a good place now. You are listening to Perspectives with Ashley Burgess.
Welcome back live to Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. Tonight we're discussing my couple of weeks in review, about my perspective, about how things kind of come together, and you see the big picture when you're really paying attention. And right before the break, I was talking about how I had listened to Rudy Tanzi, the PhD, the neurology professor at Harvard, the director of genetics and aging research unit in Massachusetts General, talk about Alzheimer's and talk about dementia, and how, you know, they're expecting that in 2047, 100 million cases of dementia worldwide. And I was thinking about that as I'm dealing with my friend and going through, you know, Danny going through detox and all this stuff, and then realizing that remembering his mother had gotten early onset of dementia, and realizing that drugs and certain pharmaceuticals can speed up the mind's ability to create the plaques that create the dementia. It all came into full view. That encompassed with also the conversation with the gentleman to my right on the flight. Remember, I was sitting in the middle seat, no arm room. Glad I didn't flare up about that. I wouldn't have gotten to hear the other stuff. And it was very interesting because all of this combined for me to have specific, observant, conscious evaluation of a situation that usually would have been misdiagnosed. So let's go a step further. So, you know, let's go back to the conference real quick. So, you know, conference day two, I got to hear a few different speakers talk. And so, again, you have to remember that each one, we all pick different tracks. And I actually showed up early for Michael Yee's speech, and that was all about surgical leadership beyond the operating room. And it was interesting because he did a big thing on jerk versus like mindful physician. And I thought that was very interesting. And he actually very spoke from the heart at one point, saying that something had happened to him that week that had really just knocked him off his feet. And that he really is wondering why he does what he does. He's really wondering why he puts himself through this amount of you know, crap to help these people that don't seem to care. And he is he directs the UCLA endocrine surgical unit. And, you know, he went to Stanford and Harvard, and he trained as a general surgeon at U.S. San Francisco. Very interesting, man. Very interesting. And I give kudos to him because he was very honest and very poignant. And he didn't have to be. You know, he could have just been whatever, but he was very poignant and very interesting. And so I got there, and I heard some of that, and it was a really great speech. And then the next thing you know, I get to hear a man named John Ratz. And John Ratz is really transforming the world by transforming entertainment and media from within. And he is the founder and CEO of the Visionary Group. And a lot of people call him a modern-day Renaissance man. It's very interesting because he believes in ethical and spiritual expression. He's been a personal manager in the entertainment industry, represents a lot of high-profile celebrities and actors. And the interesting thing about him is that he's worked on a lot of projects like... he actually kind of represented and led, you know, What the Bleep Do We Know, The 11th Hour, Dead Can Dance, Peter Russell, Eckhart Tolle. Eckhart Tolle and him are working on a new film coming up, Deepak Chopra, Madonna, and John Kerry. I'm sorry, not John Kerry, Jim Kerry. Not the politician, Jim Carrey. And it was very interesting because they actually won an award for being mindful and being spiritual and all that great stuff and storytelling and about being a, you know, a high-form storyteller in the industry. And I thought it was very cool. And, you know, he was nominated against a lot of his peers in the industry, and he actually received an award at the conference, at the Coaching and Leadership in Healthcare Conference. And he was talking about holistic values, about how he's talking about holistic values and how and where and what we want to do, what we want to do to become something, and how the action is based on inspiration, how it's based on inspiration, and how there's got to be a definite paradigm shift when it comes to, you know, what people are watching on TV, the movies they have, and that sort of thing. And it was very interesting because they right before he got up there and spoke, it was neat because I'd already heard his name. And about a week before, I was on the phone with some people I know up in British Columbia, and they told me that they knew they were actually on the set of Eckhart Tolle's newest film, and that they had met some people anyway. So there's an overlap here. They actually knew each other. And I thought that was very interesting. And so as I'm listening to this, and the next thing you know, they broke into the conversation and they said, by the way, Jim Carrey, he thought he was going to actually be able to show up here, but instead he's going to Skype. And it was a very interesting Skype because he actually talked about where he was in his life. His deep thoughts, his spirituality, the foods that he has cut out of his diet in order to alleviate inflammation. Because you know what? Inflammation is one of the biggest ways that we get dementia. Inflammation is one of the worst things that we can do for our body. And so he was talking about how he had taken out breads and dairy and sugars and everything else. And it was very interesting to listen to and very inspiring. And I've always wanted to interview him, which, you know, I get the chance. I always wanted to interview him on Perspectives, and I look forward to doing a long, long interview and really being able to identify and see, you know, Jim Carrey for Jim Carrey. And he was hilarious and very funny and very comedic, but also very genuine and very true. And I don't know about you, but just recently in the news, just a day and a half later, 2 days later, after that, his girlfriend ODs on drugs, commit suicide. And I think that they had broken up over a period of time. And I think it was an on again, off again thing. And so I started thinking, and this is like a deep, you know, contemplative thing. Think about it. I mean, he has really transformed. I know a lot of people might not realize it. He is a comedian, but he has really gotten very deep. And I started thinking, I was like, how would you be with somebody that's still doing lots of drugs if you're so deep? And then I realized that my friend Danny is a friend of mine, and he did a lot of drugs. But see, our friendship had kind of waned as far as how much we were spending time together. I mean, we rarely saw each other, maybe once a month. And I think that was more because he was embarrassed and didn't know how to tell me that he had fallen off the wagon. However, I started wondering, I was like, I couldn't be married to Danny with my level of authenticness right now. I mean, even no matter how much I love Danny, if we were together, I couldn't be with him and have that level of honesty and authentic and truly living my life. And so then I started thinking, I was like, how can Jim Carrey be together with a girl that actually turns around and dies and ODs on drugs? And so at first, my first thought was, well, maybe Jim Carrey's not that evolved. Maybe a lot of this is a dog and pony show. Maybe he is also at a crossroads. And then I started thinking a lot more deeper than that. Well, how many times have we dated someone that we thought we could save? How many times have we dated someone that we thought we could save? And I realized I've done that in the past. And I've realized that that can be easily done, especially I think more a man wants to save a woman more than a woman wants to save a man. But I think that some of us all have those same feelings, those desires, those animal instincts, those parenting instincts for some of you, motherly instinct. So I thought about it that way. And then I thought about how they'd broken up several times. And I wondered, you know, there's also different chances where you meet somebody when you're in a certain space, but you don't live with that space and you walk out of that space and then that person's still in the space. What do you do then? I mean, you care about that person and you want to see them get better, but what happens when they don't? You break up with them, right? All of a sudden they come back around, they're telling you they're doing a lot better. What do? You take them back. What happens again? They do something crazy. They're doing drugs at your house, whatever's going down. You break up with them. 3 weeks later, they say that they're off it. You take them back. So what do we have here? So what I'm saying is that a lot of people right out there are making a lot of assumptions that, you know, how close were they? Was he really in love? Was he at the same level? Were they doing drugs together? But I think better yet, we have to look at it in the fact that I think Jim thought that he could still save someone. And I understand where that's at. And a lot of people who have, you know, in the last few years, gotten their life really on target can still miscalculate that. And some of that can be because of abandonment issues. As a child abandoned, and you want to save every wounded bird that comes your way. And for that, I'm fine with, but I think that sometimes people misconstrue that. And so I think that that is really the story behind it. And I guess he had broken up with her a few days before he was at the conference. And you know, I feel for him, and I pray that she, her soul and all that good stuff is in a good, better place where she's not in pain. But at the same point, I think that that's the case, is that sometimes we try to be everything and try to do everything and try to be the Superman and the superhero, the superwoman, when we have to sit back in reality and say, okay, what really fits my lifestyle, but better yet, who am I? And even better than that, who do I want to be better than? How do I want to be better than myself was? How can I be better than I was yesterday? Stay tuned. We're going to be talking more about what's happened in the last week and a half with me, my perspective, as well as what this means for you. Perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Burgess, will be back in. Be back this time in 2 shakes.
Turn it up and jump in the deep end on Perspectives. Now, here's Ashley.
Welcome back live to Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. I've been talking about my perspective in the last few weeks, about the last few days, and how a lot of things have culminated together to create some amazing stuff. You know, I went to that conference, that coaching and leadership conference in healthcare at Harvard University, and I got to listen to a lot of speakers and a lot of amazing doctors and PhD people really tell me about, you know, some very deep stuff that I was able to integrate into my life absolutely immediately. You know, I got to hear one speaker, which will also come on the show. He's already agreed to it. Yes, yes, I get these people to agree to this, man. I mean, I even have pictures and proof that they agree to be on the show. Otto Scharmer. He's the author of The Theory U and the co-author of the newly released Leading from the Emerging Future from Ecosystem to Ecosystem Economies. He's a very interesting man, and he has programs at MIT and MITx and the U Lab. And it's really interesting because he's a senior lecturer at the MIT Sloan School of Management. and the founding chair of MIT Ideas Program. Yeah, this guy is kind of like a genius. And I got to see it, sit in there on his in his class, which was very interesting, and talk about dealing with kind of the blind spot of what we deal with in business, in the system, and how systems become antiquated and don't work. And you could look at it as like a hospital system, how it becomes antiquated and doesn't work. You can look at it in our political system. You can look at it in your office. I mean, we have all kinds of crazy stuff that's going on that doesn't work, but we don't know how to change it. We don't know how to make it better. And, you know, listening to him at first, I mean, I'll tell you at the very beginning of it, I was like, oh my God, I picked the wrong track. But I definitely picked the right one because I realized there's so many ways that we can go around things that we don't really pay attention to. There's so many things that we can do to make the system better, to make ourselves better, that we don't really focus on. And it was very interesting being in that room with him because he really talked about some very interesting stuff that I thought was very neat. And I got to kind of sit back and see, you know, hey, that's true. There is a lot of things in our system that's not working. How do we change the system? How do we reform the system? And how do we get better? And I think that was a very interesting thing. And we ended up becoming friends, very nice person, and I really enjoyed it. And then at the end, David White was a poet, very interesting guy. He's the associate fellow at the said business school at the University of Oxford, and he's a poet and is very neat, and is looking at poetry from a specific thought process of being mindful, but working with poetry to deal with depression, anxiety, and he's an amazing poet and writes some amazing stuff. And it was an interesting kind of decompression toward the end of the conference. And so after listening to this stuff and being able to hear you know, some of the poems that he had just recently written, which were very interesting. And it was funny because the lady next to me was recording on her phone, video recording him, you know, reading a poem. And like after the second time, he was like, ma'am, please refrain from any sort of photography or videotaping. Thank you. And he goes right back into the poem. I don't know about y'all, but anytime that I ever, if I was to ever get reprimanded like that, I don't know what it is, but I always get red faced, you know what I'm saying? But I never looked at her. I just kind of like looked away, you know? And so we listened to that. And toward the end, I remember the people that I actually knew that were going to be at the conference, besides a few people I had met, had already left because they live in Boston. And you know how it is. I think this is an interesting quandary as well. So think about it. So they live in Boston. I think that's the hardest thing with a conference. Is that when you live somewhere and you're married and you have kids, it's hard to give your full all into a conference because you can't like stay out really late because that gets weird and your family's like, hey, you know what I mean? I mean, you got to come home. The second thing is that you're kind of like used to being there. And the third thing is that, you know, you just kind of, I don't know, you kind of like get over it fast. And I realized that in order to get the most out of this conference, I needed to be there as much as I could. And so I stayed for everything, and I absolutely loved it. And at the end of the conference, I said goodbye to some people. And as I was leaving, I ran into, I had met somebody and another person in Canada that I really, really liked. Several people in Canada, actually, in Argentina and all over the place. Very neat. Colombia, China, and a friend of mine from Canada. And she was like, you know, hey, her husband was there with her, not at the conference, but had come into Boston with her. And she goes, well, hey, I'm going to walk back to the hotel to see my husband. I said, you know what? I'll walk with you. So we ended up walking. She's like, are you sure? I was like, yeah. I mean, it's the direction of my hotel. So we walk back that way. And as we're walking back and we're talking and we're laughing about the conference, and she and I are sharing some things that are just so ironic. She had said something to somebody right before she saw me. And then I turned around and said the exact same thing to her, which was so wild. And she said, that's exactly what I said right before I saw you. And so we're walking across, we're walking down the street, we're walking around, we're getting very close to the water, and we see a bar / restaurant off the side of the harbor. And, you know, remember, it's a Saturday evening, it's about 6:30, and the place is totally packed. And they have a live band, and I said, you know what, I would really like to go by there and check it out. I know you need to go see your husband. She goes, you know what? I'm going to go on and text him on WeChat and, you know, let him know that I'm going to grab a drink with you. And I said, see if he wants to come. So she's like, yeah, you know, that's what I'm going to do. So we go in there and we meet a bunch of people, and it was very interesting because about three people came up to me and said, "Hey, long time no see. How you doing?" I was like, "Hey, how you doing?" And I didn't want to sit there and say, "Oh, I don't know you." And so, you know, I was like, "Yeah, it's great to see you." And then I got to meet one of them. They just newly got married, and another guy just got a girlfriend. He's like, "You remember my girlfriend, Sally?" And so I'm like, "Hey, how you doing?" So we talked, and it was interesting because I started looking around and I realized that this was a charity event. And when we got to the bar, she ordered a drink for me and ordered a drink for her. And the guy said, "Are you at the charity event?" And she said, "No." And he said, "Oh, okay. Well, then it's, $16, whatever." So she paid. She's like, "Oh, crap, I could have gotten free drinks." I was like, "Well, you know, karma would have gotten us back at the end on that one. I would have liked to have gotten a free drink, but I get it." Right after I say that, somebody runs into me, knocks my drink over. It goes all over the bar. And I'm like, "Oh, goodness." And the guy's like, "Let me get you a free drink here." So in the end, I got my free drink, right? And so we end up like meeting all these neat people. And I realize that the event, the charity event, is to benefit certain survivors from the Boston bombing marathon. The bombing of the Boston marathon. And it was so amazing because I was like, "Oh my gosh, this is actually to benefit them." And I was so interested and so amazed because I walked right in on it. And so I asked one of the men that was talking to us, I asked him, I said, "Hey, you know, whose event is this?" And he goes, "It's Heather Abbott. It's the Heather Abbott Foundation." And she was one of the people that lost their limbs, their leg, in the bombing. And I was like, "Oh my gosh." And so I said, "Where is she?" And he goes, "Oh, she's outside. She's right outside. She's right there." So I walk right out there, and there were some people talking to her that also had prosthetics. And then she and I started talking, and I was like, "You know, I definitely want to have you on the show." And she's like, "I definitely want to be on. I kind of have a lot to say right now." And so we talked for a while, and then I ended up meeting this other lady, and I said, "So where are you in the situation?" She goes, "Well, I was actually living at Heather's house, and we were running in the marathon together." And she goes, "And there's not a day that goes by that I don't think, why couldn't it have been me?" She goes, I can't believe that I'm whole. I didn't lose any limbs." She goes, we all went to grab a drink before the race. And we all got in line and we all started running. And the next thing you know, we heard something and I couldn't find Heather. And she goes, "And the thing is that, you know, Heather's single and you know, it's hard on her." And it was very interesting. I said, "Well, it sounds like it's very hard on you." And so I want to have both of them on and discuss life after this. Because I think when there's like a whirlwind of press and a whirlwind of emotion, it's one thing to deal with it. But I think it's got to be hard. It's got to be very difficult. And, you know, who had what happen? Who had what happen? And the who had what happen is very difficult. But I got to meet a lot of very neat people from that experience. And I bought a t-shirt. I donated some money to the organization. I mean, not a lot. I'm on radio salary, right? But donated some money to that. And I felt good about it. And it was a very interesting scenario. And the next thing you know, her husband, my friend's husband, Tracy, comes by. And he had been trying to get into the Samuel Adams Brewery, but he closed before he got there. And so he had a beer, and then we ended up walking together toward my hotel and grabbed a bite. And it was just so fun and so exciting. And we got to talk about the conference and deeply discuss a lot of different things. And it was just a really neat thing. And it was kind of, I got to really meet a lot of people, and I got to have a really good dialogue with. And I got to meet some people after they left. I actually met some other people, and it was very neat. People that lived on some boats, and I met a beekeeper. But I remember I went to bed and I woke up the next morning and I was a little sad. I had really learned a lot and taken in a lot during the conference in my mind, and I just felt so happy and I was doing my power poses and I was so stoked about the whole situation. And I got a little down because I was like, "Man, I'm really going to miss this. I'm really going to miss this." And we were trying to talk about more about what happened as well as what's been going on lately. And some other stuff that's really put things into focus. Stay tuned because Perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Burgess, will be back in. Be back this time in two shakes.
This is Jake Busey, and you're listening to Perspectives with Ashley Burgess.
Welcome back live to Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. So, okay, so I'm leaving the conference. You know, it was Sunday, and I'm getting up out of bed at the hotel. And it was funny because every day I'd gotten up way early compared to Sunday morning because I knew it was over. The conference was over. That was it. And I'd really, really enjoyed myself at the conference. It felt like presidential classroom all over again. And I was in the right place at the right time. I mean, heck, even Jim Carrey was there. And it's like I realize in life, it's like, you know, when you're in the right place at the right time, everybody's speaking right to you. Every single thing they have to say has some sort of information that you can download, that you can take. I mean, I even got two drugs that you can take. Not drugs like you have to get a prescription for, but there's a drug called Cat's Claw, and I'd have to spell out the other one because I don't know how to spell it or how to say it, but Cat's Claw is a good drug that you can take to offset dementia. And, you know, basically it helps make the plaques not be able to be created in the brain or and the connections. It's very interesting stuff. And so you can start taking Cat's Claw. I just got some. No, I don't have my own Cat's Claw. The Burgess Pharmaceuticals does not. But sooner than later, I'd like to have a really amazing organic, known organic, where we get it from, where you get it from the rainforest product. And I look forward to that. So there you go. So I learned a lot about that. And I'm leaving the hotel. And I'm about to head to the airport. And, you know, it was kind of bittersweet. And, you know, I got the Uber and I get to the airport. And, you know, all of a sudden I was thinking, man, I just can't believe that this is over with. And get on the flight. And I got the middle seat. Remember? I'm like, oh, got the middle seat. It was in an exit row, but I still got the middle seat. So at least I got some leg room for sure. And then I ended up talking to the folks around me because, again, there was something that was broken. It was pretty funny. So, I mean, it was funny in its own way where we were about to leave and they're like, well, we're going to have to stay around a little bit. We have a blah, 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 that's broken, but we have two. So we're only supposed to be flying with one. I mean, we can only fly with one and we're fine. So we're just trying to get clearance. We're going to send out the paperwork and get that done. And it was funny because when we were right before we started boarding the flight, I saw an airplane maintenance man getting off the plane holding duct tape. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, what are they duct taping now? Anyway, I guess the duct tape didn't work. So I was going off about how the duct tape obviously didn't work. But I got to know the people around me. And about right after we finally, it was about 2 hour wait. And we finally get in the air. And right when we get in the air, I'm able to start writing again. And I'm going to be on the Speakers Guild soon and on the speaking tour doing some really amazing speeches, hopefully. And I started writing a speech and it just started flowing. And it was funny because my seatmate was like, I'd like to make a comment about that. And I said, you know, you got to give me a little while. I've had writer's block and I really need to finish writing. And then none of these people sitting next to me knew, like, what I meant by writing. 22 pages later, my arm and my hand has complete carpal. I was like, okay. And they were like, holy crap. And I was able to start writing out the speech. And all of a sudden, it was, like, just coming to me. And I realized that in order to really write this speech in a really amazing way, I had to go through this conference. I had to deal with it. But I also had to deal with the sadness that it was behind me. I mean, it's always going to be a part of me. And I realize that I don't do a lot of things like this, that I need to do more things that really, you know, kind of like, I don't know, they just like light my fire, you know? It's like, yeah, baby. You know, I need to do more things like that that really just connect. And I think a lot of times that we don't do that because of our own personal reasons. We have work, we have stuff, but I think that all of us to some degree need to find what we truly love and do it several times a year and really pay attention to that. And then it's just like, it's an amazing, joyful thing. And maybe it wouldn't have been so amazing and joyful if I did it all the time, you know? And I think that that's like some of my colleagues were, oh, I don't want to hear about dementia. Oh, I don't want to hear about this. Oh, I don't want to hear about that. You know, I'm gonna head over to the bar or I'm going to go head home or whatever it was. And I totally understand, but I wanted to get as much out of it as possible. So I write this speech, and it's really great. And, you know, Greg comes and picks me up at the airport. You know, for to get at the airport at 9 a.m. in Boston and not land and get my bag until 5 p.m. in Dallas, a little bit of time there. It's a long day on that one flight. And we get home, and I was like, you know what? Let's go to the grocery store. We were going to go to a neighborhood Mexican restaurant. I was like, let's just go to the grocery store and do the right thing. And as I got ready for social media for, you know, my Sunday show, I started updating social media for the Sunday show, letting people know what I was going to be talking about. And we headed out to Central Market to go grab some food. And we got there, and all of a sudden, I started thinking what Jim Carrey had said. You know, he eats lots of vegetables, lots of leafy greens. No dairy. No processed foods. No processed sugars. And so I quickly went to the kale, and I began to get some kale and some various greens. And some romaine and some this and that. And I got that, and you know, it was just so good. And we got home, and I made this amazing salad, and I was delighted that I had actually started. I always have eaten very well, like healthy, but I could always eat healthier. And so I took that away from that. And so now I'm making salads. So ever since Sunday night, I'm making amazing salads every night and coupling it up with just pure protein. And it just is so good. And the better things are for you, I think the better they eventually taste. And at the beginning, it might not taste that good to you. But I swear, once you get used to it, everything else is kind of like processed, taste processed. Well, in a little while, we'll go back to my speech, but I think that the speech needs to be talked about later on down the road. So let's jump into Monday. Monday, remember I was helping my friend Danny decide that he really did need to be in rehab. But not only rehab, I also helped this whole family realize that Danny has mental stuff that he has to deal with. It's not just the drugs, and that we need to be looking at some other issues as well. And everybody except for the people that are too emotionally involved can see that. His dad has a difficult time because he's hurt his dad so much with the drugs and the lying, that it's hurt his dad. However, eventually they'll get over that and they'll get past this and they'll move on. And his brother has deemed that he will not speak to Danny at all because Danny is ruining everything. However, Danny's brother is a recovering addict. And I believe that it's too close for his brother to deal with. I believe that Danny is stirring up a lot of emotions within him. And it's too close. And I explained it to some of his family. I said, the thing is, it's like a dry drunk. It's like anybody that got over something but necessarily hasn't gotten over it. And I said, I can give you a good example in my personal life. And everybody was like, well, okay, you know, therapist speaks up. And I said, a long time ago, I smoked cigarettes, right? And I smoked for a while, and then I quit. And I quit for 7 years. But in that time of quitting for 7 years, I was a jerk. I didn't like people around me smoking. I made a big deal of it. When I would go to a restaurant and there were smokers, I would literally be like, I cannot believe that you allow smokers in this institution. You have them sitting right here next to me. For the love of all that's holy. And so I wasn't a very good ex-smoker. If anything, I was a tirade to be around when there were smokers. And so after 7 years, I ended up running into some old school friends, and I was also working on a book about the insides of rehabs, and I was talking to people that were in rehabilitation, and when rehabilitation, like, everybody smokes, okay? FYI, I was the only person in this whole room that wasn't smoking, and on the third day that I went in there to do interviews, I was like, yeah, give me one of those. I took a cigarette, and I smoked it like I used to smoke. I almost threw up right then and there. Okay, everybody looked at me, they're like, are you okay? You look kind of green. I was like, I'm going to have to go. I'm going to go to Whole Foods. I'm going to beg and plead that they have something to make me feel not feel so bad. I'm going to pray to God that they have something that, you know, I'm not going to feel so green and so sick. And I remember driving up to the Whole Foods, and I went in there, and I got some of that ginger, that liquid ginger. I got all kinds of stuff, all this stuff. Yeah, it didn't work. I had to wait. You know, it was about 24 hours of going through that. But you know what I did the next day? I smoked again. And so we were trying to be talking about what I explained to that family and how I put it in the fact of how sometimes it's hard for certain people to deal with people who are going through issues because sometimes it's too close to them. Stay tuned because Perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Burgess, will be back in. Be back this time in two shakes.
You could be my luck. Get in here. You're listening to Perspectives with Ashley Burgess. We'll be safe and sound.
Welcome back live to Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. So right before the break, I was talking about how my friend Danny needed to go to rehab and how his family just thought that he was just a drug addict, but there's more to it. He has depression. He has some mental issues that he has to get through. But even bigger, he might actually be having a little early onset of dementia. And when I was able to explain that to some people in the family, they totally had already thought about that and were in agreement. However, two people in the family, his dad, which is so emotionally centered in this, and his dad had been lied to so much that his dad was having a hard time believing much of anything. And so I can totally understand that. But eventually his dad's going to come around. Because his dad loves him and he'll eventually come around and he'll realize it. But however, in the process, that's not a worry to me. As long as most of the people get it and he goes into rehab, which he did. He went in two days ago. And he sounded really good when he was going in. And I'll get to see him in about 30, 40 days for his first visitation. And one of the family members was telling me about how his older brother was very angry with him. And I said, okay. And they said, but by the way, his older brother used to be, you know, addicted to drugs and is now sober. And I said, well, first off, he sees a lot of himself in Danny. I said, but the bigger issue is that when I quit smoking, and I gave him an example, I said, sometimes you might have gotten over something, but you haven't gotten over it. When I quit smoking the first time, I was a jerk to be around. When people were smoking around me, I was an absolute jerk. When I would go to a restaurant, people were smoking, I would freak out. I'm never coming back to this establishment. I can't believe you run your operation like this. And then I was doing a book on rehab facilities and the process of rehab and what people go through. And so I was going to rehab facilities. And if anybody's ever been to a rehab facility, you know that most people in rehab smoke. And so as I'm doing a lot of these interviews, I ended up taking a cigarette and I smoked one just like I had smoked in the past, like, sucking it down. And I got very green, very, very sicky feeling. And I had to leave and I was praying that Whole Foods would have this miracle thing that I would instantaneously not feel green and feel so much better. And they didn't have that. I bought a bunch of stuff. I put it in the car. I drove home and I sat with my green, palish feeling self and, you know, dealt with it. 2 days later, I smoked again. And guess what? I started smoking again for 3 solid years. And at the end of almost that, I think it had been a little less than 3 years, about 2.5 years. And I was in a conference in California getting my licensing stuff for my coaching because, you know, everybody likes a therapist. Some people hate a therapist. So some people want to coach. Got to have the best of both worlds. And so I was getting my licensing for that. And I remember I woke up one morning and I said, you know what? I'm not ever going to smoke again. And I haven't. Let me knock on some sort of wood here. Okay. And I haven't smoked. There's a big change in me, though. From the first time I quit to the last time I quit. The biggest change is that I can be around anybody smoking and it doesn't bug me. After being quit for 24 hours, I was going on the news. I was going on ABC and I remember my makeup artist, it was very early in the morning, and my makeup artist goes, you know what? I screwed up. And I go, what do you mean you screwed up? She goes, I screwed up. And I go, oh my God. I go, I can smell smoke. She goes, I know. She goes, I tried to quit, but this morning when I woke up and I was running late, I got stressed out and I smoked a cigarette. And she goes, I am so sorry. And it was cold outside too. So you know how when people smoke outside and it's cold, it like attaches to your clothing, you know? And she goes, Ashley, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And I said, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I go, my biggest concern right now is that I will be able to think. And she goes, what do you mean? And I go, for a while there, I started using cigarettes as a crutch to think, thinking that I was more enlightened. The more I smoked, it seemed like the ideas came to me faster. And so that was a good interview. It was hard for me. I feel like it was an 85, 88. Had I smoked a cigarette, it could have been 100. But anyway, the very next day, I was out and about with people smoking, and it didn't bug me. The only time that cigarettes bug me is if I'm in an enclosed car. And I think even most smokers can't be doing that. But I realized that was the big change for me to realize that smoking was no longer something I was addicted to. Quite the contrary. I had seen, I had conquered, I had overcome, and I let it go. And I felt really good about that. And so when I go back to Danny's family and I said, you know what, probably the idea of him and his brother spending time together is not a good idea. And Danny's brother said that he had blocked Danny from calling him. And I said, that's probably the best thing because I don't think that Danny's fully gotten over being an addict. And because he hasn't, he can't see the forest through the trees when he's dealing with Danny. And if I'm right on any of these calculations, all he does is scare Danny or stress him out. And the rest of the family members agreed. And I look back at the conference at Harvard and I realize that I learned so much. And I remember, you know, a friend of mine in Boston, and we were leaving one of the speakers, and we were going in. I was going into the big room for the conference, Dr. Rudy's speech on Alzheimer's. And I remember looking at her, and she's like, "Yeah, I'm not going to go for it. I'm going to leave." And I remember, had I had left, I would have missed out on all this. And one of the big takeaways, and this is something I want to share with you tonight. A lot of people will tell you what to do, and a lot of people will give you good ideas. And there'll be a lot of people that are going to share ideas with you of things that they're going to do and what's good for them. But you got to look at yourself and figure out what's good for you. I've realized that in life, there's a lot of things that people want you to do, whether or not that's a good thing for you. That's to be determined. And I think that when you're on a direction and when you're going toward a certain purpose, if their purpose doesn't align with your purpose, you keep on going. You could have similar purposes, but it's for you to decide. Had I had left that last talk that day, the first day of the conference, I would have never really put two and two together. Especially that coupled with the conversation on the plane really helped me hone in on actual things that Danny had said, especially about his things and wanting to see his stuff and wanting to be at his home. And why was everybody being so mean? And all that kind of stuff just kind of came into play. And I realized it. The same goes for some other people that were at the conference the last day. And after one track, they were leaving. And I said, where are you going? They go, oh, we're leaving. We have this or that to do. And I went, You're not gonna stay for the last thing. And it kind of made me kind of sad because I just assumed that we were going to stay together and then hang out after. And they're like, no. Had I not stayed for that, I would never run into my friend Tracy. We wouldn't have walked together back to her hotel. We wouldn't have ended up sidetracking to that cool bar where we met the survivors of the bombing of the Boston Marathon. I wouldn't have been able to talk to those women and some of those men that were able to confide with me and want to be on the show to express their life changes and the things that they've gone through. I wouldn't have been able to buy a t-shirt and donate and meet other people. It's just interesting. I wouldn't have had a great dinner. I wouldn't have run into women that were trying to get me to go to Madonna with them, and they were trying to score me a ticket, and I had just met them. Those were pretty cool women out there. Thank you. I would have liked to have gone. If y'all could have gotten another ticket, I would have definitely gone. I'm not that huge of a fan, but I do respect her work. And if somebody's going to give me a ticket, I wasn't going to argue. I wouldn't have met the beekeeper in Maine. I wouldn't have met any of those people that live on their boats. And I wouldn't have met that lady that I actually helped her with dealing with the passing of her mother. None of that would have come to pass if I wouldn't have done exactly what I felt like I should do. I feel like that is direction. When we know our direction, we have our purpose. When we have our purpose, we follow that. We do it authentically and as a leader. Stay tuned. I know that this show is going to end and another show is going to begin in this time slot. However, if you want to hear the third hour of the show, go to Spreaker. If you want to hear the third hour of the show, go to Speaker with an R, Spreaker. It will be up and ready in the next few minutes for you to listen to. It'll be more about things that have happened, things that have gone on, dealing with my personal family issues, and how those personal family issues have shaped the way I see the world, as well as dealing with regret and the loss of a family member. Stay tuned, because Perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Burgess. Oh, wait. Always remember, more answers, less questions. Check out AshleyBurgess.com. Check out Ashley Burgess Network. Perspectives with Ashley Burgess will be back in, well, this time, you know it, back in three shakes.